Okay, it's a continuation really of our partnership series. This is a sugya that sometimes discussed in the context of kinyanim, of sales of property, sometimes discussed in the context of neighborly laws, roshchenim, sometimes discussed in the context of partnerships, and that is bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is not bar mitzvah. Obviously, if you become a bar mitzvah, you're chayev in all mitzvahs, including bar mitzvah. But bar mitzvah is a special law of a butter's rights. A person who's a neighbor of a property that's being sold has special rights to purchase the property prior to anybody else who does not own land adjacent to the property which is being sold. This comes up in the context of shutfus. That's really, it's in the middle of the discussion of Hilchos Shutfim in Shulchan Aruch. It's the main siman. Hilchos Shutfim is Simen Kufay and Vav. This is in Simen Kufay and Hay. And of course, a Shutaf has a greater amount of precedent, the Gemara explains, than somebody else. If, let's say, there are partners and one partner wants to sell a piece of the property to somebody else, so the partner who already has rights in the property can take precedence, can say, wait, I want it. I don't necessarily want somebody else to come into the partnership. I'm interested in having the property myself. That is on a higher level, the Gemara explains. That's a stronger right than somebody who doesn't already have a right to the property, just adjacent to the property. So that is not based on the din of Shutaf per se, but it's based on the din of Asisa Yosha Be'atov. You're supposed to always act in an upright and a good fashion. That's the pasuk in the Devarim Parshas Ve'eschon, V'asisa Yoshev Etov B'nei Hashem. So the Ramban says right there in that pasuk, this is an inyan gadol. This is a very important matter. Because in the Torah, it's impossible to ask the Torah and Hagos Adam Shkenev Reiv, B'chom Asom Atanav Tekunei Yishuv. Torah can't mention every single situation that occurs, exactly what's going to be the right and ethical thing to do. It gives you general principles and tells you certain things that are considered to be proper ethical behavior, like lo seilech rochio, don't speak lashon hara, lo sikam lo sita, don't take revenge, lo saman adam yecha, don't stand idly by your brother's blood, lo sekaleo cheresh, don't curse people, b'nei seva takum, be nice to old people and respectful to them, k'yotze behem, and so forth. The Torah gives you a catch-all obligation that you should understand that it's not just these specific laws, but you're always supposed to do the ethical and upright thing. You're supposed to compromise with people, you're supposed to go act above and beyond the letter of the law. And this special din that Chazal mentioned in the Gemara in Baba Mesia, Dafa Kufches Samen Av to Kufches Samen Beis, that's the main sugya in the Gemara, appears in a number of other sugyas as well. It's the main sugya Bar Mitzvah of this notion. So the Ramban says this is one instance where we give a specific application of this idea of Asisa Yoshev Yatov. Most of the time, we say, Ein kofen al lepnei mishuras hadin. That's how the Ramah paskins in Hilchos Dayanim. We don't compel people to act above and beyond the letter of the law. Even if that's included within proper ethical behavior, it's not something that we compel. However, in the context of this particular din of Bar Mitzvah, we actually compel. We compel a person to act in this upright fashion. Somebody is selling their land, so we say it's appropriate. If the neighbor who lives next door wants the land and is willing to buy the land at exactly the same price and the same terms in which you could sell it to somebody else, then you're supposed to sell it to the neighbor. Really, the main obligation, the Aruch HaShulchan points out, in the very beginning of Simen Kuf Ayin Hey, very interestingly enough, the main obligation of Asisa Yashav Yatov devolves upon the lokeach. Devolves upon the lokeach, the purchaser. From the seller's perspective, he's happy to sell to anybody, presumably. He or she is happy to sell to anybody who's prepared to pay the price that the seller is looking for. But the purchaser goes and buys the property and then gets a knock on the door immediately afterwards from the next door neighbor saying, oh, I didn't know this property was for sale. I understand that you bought the property. How much did you pay for it? And the purchaser says, I paid $1 million for it. So the next door neighbor says, great, here's $1 million and give the property to me. So the purchaser, so this is an obligation upon the purchaser at that point in time. Even if the seller never did anything, the seller never mentioned anything to the neighbor. In fact, we don't find that there's necessarily an obligation for the seller to mention anything to the neighbor. The neighbor finds that at that point in time, says, I want to purchase the property. So the lokeach is obligated to then sell the property to the neighbor. Explains the Aruch HaShulchan, Iker Chiyav HaLokeach, the main obligation is upon Lokeach. It's not, I didn't put everything in here, I put a lot. To a Yachal Liknos from Malkom Acher, because Lokeach has the opportunity to buy property somewhere else. If you're going to pay the price, so then you can buy another piece of property. You don't have to buy specifically this piece of property. Interestingly enough, Ramban is not the only one who explains that this is sort of an rabbinic expansion or application of the general Deraisa notion of Asisa HaYashar Ve'atov. The Magen Mishnah says exactly the same thing. Magen Mishnah in Hilchos Shkeinim and the Rambam Perek Yudad Halacha Hei says Vinyan Dinu Ben HaMeitzer Hushet Toroseinu Atzmim Menasna V'tikun Midos HaAdam, that the Torah is supposed to refine our character traits. That we have general principles of behavior, like be holy, right? And you shouldn't always follow your taivas. So he explains, he says that we have a few times in the Torah that we're given sort of general directives about what our behavior should be. But we can't, but we can't spell out every single detail. So therefore the Chachamim, Kasut Sasapratim. The Chachamim wrote some of the details, and this is one of the details. So Bukdin and Debar Metzah is a detail that's required by Chazal based on this principle of Yisisa Yosha Ve'atov. So the Mesugi and Bava Mesiyah Dav Kuch Fechesam and Al really spells out the basic principles. We'll run through some of the cases, a whole bunch of cases. They're starting from the bottom of Kuchesam and Al until the conclusion of Dav Kuchesam Amud Beis. It says that if you have, let's say, partners that own field, that own two fields, one on this side and one on the other side, and somebody goes in and they buy a field in the middle, so it's a chutzpah. So Rav Nachman says, Misalkinan, that the person who bought the middle field, that the partners come along and they say, wait a second, this is, we have a straight line of fields over here, and you interrupted our straight line of fields by buying one in the middle, so you gotta sell it to us. So we say, yeah, so that's an obligation, because the shutpim really have a direct possessory interest. What about if it is a dinar de bar mitzvah? What if it is based on just a neighbor who wants the ability to buy property that was sold next door? So then we have a machlokis, whether the neighbor has the right to force the seller to sell the neighbor the property force the purchaser who purchased the property to turn around and sell it to the neighbor. And we paskin like the Nahardai, who say, even if I'm not dealing with Shutpim, even if it's just Dina de Bar Metzah, we force the sale. Now what if the person who is the Lokeach had said to the neighbor ahead of time, as sort of a preemptive strike, the purchaser had said that do you want to buy this field? And the neighbor responded, Zil Zavon. And he said, no, you go and buy the field. So does that mean that the purchaser is now off the hook if the neighbor then afterwards says, I want to buy the field from you? So then how do I say, yeah, if there wasn't a kinyan, if there wasn't an actual kinyan that was made where the a neighbor relinquished his rights to purchase the adjacent field after the sale would be current consummated, so then it's not considered to be a binding commitment. The fact that he said, oh, go and buy it for yourself. Because we could say the reason why the neighbor said, go buy it for yourself, is because if the neighbor would express interest, so the neighbor has presumably more of an urgency to purchase this property than anybody else. So then it's more likely that the seller is going to ramp up the price. So therefore, he doesn't want to admit to the seller, to the purchaser, that he's interested in buying the property himself. On the other hand, if he said explicitly to the Rishonim, say that if he had said Ramah, that in the event that the neighbor said explicitly to the seller that I'm not interested in the field, you could do whatever you want with the field. So then, if he made that statement to the seller when the seller is giving him terms, so he knows what the terms are going to be at that point in time. He's not worried. He doesn't have to worry that the seller is going to, find out about his interest and make it a higher price. The seller's telling him what the price is going to be. So then, that is considered to be a good waiver. But there's a Knesset HaGedoyla who says, yeah, it's a good waiver insofar as after the kinyan has taken place, after the field has then been sold to the purchaser by the seller, then the neighbor wouldn't be able to insist on buying the field anymore. But if the neighbor wanted to change his mind that before the sale took place, so he would still have the right, because it's not considered to be chal until the sale actually takes place. So the Beis Din of America had a case a number of years ago, about 7 years or 6.5 years ago or so. They had a case where there was a person, a neighbor, who was very interested in buying the house next door, and would say to a long time to the seller that I'm interested in buying the house next door. That if you ever want to sell the house, at one point in time, the owner of the house, the seller, turned to the neighbor and said, "Well, I am interested, and I think I have, I have an interested buyer, and I'm willing to sell it to you for $5 million." And the neighbor said, "I want to know who's offering you this money." So the seller didn't tell him exactly who it was. It wasn't his obligation to tell him exactly who it was, who the prospective purchaser was. But the neighbor thought, this isn't really a serious offer. You know, I don't have all the details. He just wants $5 million from me. I'll offer him $4 million. He said, I'm not interested in buying $5 million. You want to do that? That's your business. But I'll give you $4 million. So the seller said, okay, great. I'm getting $5 million from this other guy. So he sold the field for $5 million to the other guy. So now he's about to sell the field for $5 million to the other guy. But now the neighbor found out that the sale was about to go through, because he found out that this was serious. So about a month and a half later, when he found out that this was, a serious matter, so he called back the seller and he said, you know what, I'm willing to pay you $5 million. I was, negotiating and only offering $4 million because I didn't think you had a serious offer on the table. But now I see you do have a serious offer on the table, so I'll give you the $5 million. So the seller said, I'm sorry, but you already waived your right. You waived your right. You told me that you aren't interested, and I have the interested purchaser. So that's the end. That's the end of the story. Because the purchaser said, "I want to go forward with the sale." In the end of the day, the seller said, "Look, what I really care about is that I get my $5 million. If it comes from the neighbor, or whether it comes from the purchaser, I'm perfectly happy. But I have a purchaser who's insisting that, he has the right to purchase the property, that there was a waiver on the part of the neighbor, so I'll do whatever the Beis Din tells me to do." So the Beis Din then had to deal, so the main person who was concerned in this case that they really wanted to get the field for the $5 million was the purchaser. And the neighbor claimed, "I want it for myself, and the waiver is not really a good waiver." So the Beis Din said, "We've drawn a distinction between if the comment of the neighbor saying that they're not interested in the field was made to the purchaser, whether it was made to the seller. If it was made to the purchaser, so then we say he could say Meshata Nibach. I didn't really mean it. I just didn't want the sale price to be jacked up. But if he said it to the seller, so then that is considered to be a good waiver, even if there wasn't a kinyan. But in this case, since the Knesset HaGedoyla says, based on a tshuva of the Avkas Rochel was, of course, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, was none other than the Beis Yosef, that if the neighbor changes his mind before the sale has actually taken place, so then the waiver is not chal, it does not take effect, even if it was made to the owner, to the seller, so therefore he has not lost his right to exercise his bar mitzvah privilege in this particular case. So therefore, on the basis of this, not only that, but they also quoted a Chemda Shlomo. So Chemda Shlomo is quoted by the Pesukei Teshuvah in Siman Kuf Ayin Hei Sifkaton Yud Aleph, who says that let's say that a waiver was made to the seller, but the seller doesn't really feel like enforcing the waiver. So though he said that whenever the din of bar mitzvah is not going to be something that whenever requiring the seller to sell to the purchaser is something that's not necessarily going to be beneficial to the seller, Because sometimes we say that, okay, when the neighbor is making it difficult for the seller, so we're not looking to make the seller's life, you know, miserable. So for example, the neighbor says that, yeah, I'm interested in buying the property, but it's going to take me a month to get a mortgage. But the purchaser is prepared to pay the money right away. So we don't tell the seller you have to wait so long, because we're looking to help the seller. So here as well, the seller is saying, I'm not interested in this monkey business that today you tell me that you're waiving it and therefore I'm proceeding with one expectation, now you're changing the expectation. So maybe he can, you know, enforce the waiver arguably. But if he's not interested in enforcing the waiver because he doesn't care if the neighbor's the one who pays the money rather than the purchaser, so then it's not binding. So then the seller can still sell it to the neighbor, and then we would still apply the principle of Bar Metzor. So based on these two principles of the Knesset Segedarim and the Chem de Shlomo, so the Beis Din ruled. Very interesting case, because people ask, is Bar Metzor just kind of like some sort of a theoretical halacha that you find in the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch, or does it still come up nowadays? So this actually came up, and the Beis Din ruled in favor of the neighbor, to say the neighbor had the right to exercise Bar Metzor rights, and that the sale would have to be sold by the owner of the property for $5 million to the neighbor, as opposed to the purchaser. So apparently, I'm assuming that the parties were understanding of the decision of the Beis Din, because the Beis Din of America, as a general rule, only publishes decisions even in anonymous form, because they change the real names of the parties when they publish this particular decision, but they only do it. I remember it from my days when I was the director of the Beis Din of America. We, even after we anonymized the names of the parties, we would still only publish the decision if we got the consent of both parties. So apparently they got the consent of both parties in this particular case. But that's, you know, one application of this principle. Now, what the Rambam says is very interesting. The Rambam says that this idea that when the purchaser purchases the property, then the neighbor could just go to the purchaser and say, I'm going to give you the amount of money that you paid for the property, as long as he does it right away. If he waits for 5 months, that's a different story. It has to be like right away when the purchaser finds out about it, or has the ability to, you know, find out about it, you know, on the spot. Let's say it was done on the sly. It was done very discreetly and very surreptitiously, so that nobody would find out about it. But as soon as it gets advertised, so then he only has like 2 minutes, only has like a couple of hours, basically, to come and make the statement. But once he makes the statement, the neighbor says, I want to buy the property, then the lokek's obligated to give it to him. So the Rambam is a very interesting statement in terms of the description of what exactly was the role of the lokek retroactively when we allowed the sale that the lokek made of the property to redound to the benefit of the neighbor. If you take a look on page 2, source Zion, Rambam says, here if the Rambam spoke about the rights of neighbors, the rights of Shudfin. If you go actually back up a little bit to the last source on page 1. So we have the halakha with respect to Shudfin there, and the Shulchan Aruch introduces the entire discussion regarding Bar Metzra, which is why we've decided to launch this discussion in the middle of a discussion of Hilchos Shudfin. One of the Shudfin sells his portion to somebody else, and either brothers of an estate who inherited an estate or other types of partners. So the other ones, they have the ability to say to the lokeach, or whoever purchased, you know, this part of the estate or this part of the partnership assets, get off, you know, the estate, or get out of the partnership, because we're paying you off. We're paying you the amount that you paid for it. Even if this person who purchased part of the partnership assets is a neighbor, he himself is a matzah, and a shutuf takes precedent, because a shutuf actually has possessory rights, you know, in the property, not just adjacent possessory rights, but they have actual possessory rights in the property, so therefore they have the right to kick the person off, to pay them off. So then the Rambam, after talking about, and the Sma, it says in the next source, the shutuf is like a super matzah. He's better than a regular matzor. Because everybody, you know, starts off with a portion in all of the partnership assets. Whoever sold part of the partnership was like they were selling part of the other partner's assets. But then the Rambam goes on and says, If an owner sells a property to purchaser, so the neighbor has the right to pay off the purchaser, and this person who did not live next door, it could be he lived 2 blocks away, If you live two blocks away, you don't have the din of a matzah. Matzah, to have a din of your, that you're a neighbor, that you can exercise by matzah rights, you have to be mamish next door. There's even like a discussion if there's like a wall in between, so you have to be able to walk from one place to the other. The original law of bar mitzvah applied to fields. You look in the Gemara, it's talking about fields, and it talks about the two fields such that you can plow them together. Is there such a distance between them that you couldn't plow them together? If you can't plow them together, then you don't have the halacha bar mitzvah. There's a question, if you're dealing with two houses, so how close do they have to be to each other? So the Taz says, you have to, there's not even a space to walk between one and the other. You just go straight from one into the other. So it's a question, what do you mean, go straight from one into the other? Presumably, there's a wall in between. So the idea is, okay, you can knock down the wall. But if it's, you know, a few houses away, that doesn't count as a bar mitzvah. Maybe if it's next door, and it's a hemshake of the house, it's a hemshake of the fields, the two fields of the two houses are next to each other, okay, so then it would be a halacha bar mitzvah. But otherwise, it doesn't matter. But this person, so this person who is the lokeach, even if he lived two blocks away, ki'ilu hu shliach shel ben ha-metzer, it's considered as if he is the agent of the ben ha-metzer. So it's considered retroactively as if he was serving as an unappointed, unsolicited agent of the neighbor who now wants to purchase the property. So it turns out that when the purchase of the property took place, the purchaser was really serving as a shliach, as an agent of the next door neighbor. So the next door neighbor really doesn't even have to enter into a new contract. The edim of the original sale can serve as the edim, basically to say, oh, it was sold to the it was sold to the bar mitzvah, because we consider it as if the shliach served, that this person was as if he was the shliach of the ben mitzvah. And now, is he a full-fledged shliach? It's hard to say if he's a full-fledged shliach. Like, for example, if he's a full-fledged shliach, so you could say, normally you could say, I only made you a shliach to get the best possible price. So the field is worth $100, and this purchaser was an nincompoop, and he bought it for $200, right? So do we say that therefore he paid too much, and the next door neighbor only has to pay him $100? Say, no! Ain't no nala karkos, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that there's no when it comes to karkos. And therefore, he has to pay the full $200. He has to pay the full $200. We see that it's not necessarily a full-fledged the shliach situation. Similarly, if the person who purchased the property takes a loan, and all of his properties are now considered to be, you know, mortgaged on some level, to pay for this loan that he took, including this property. It's a lien on all of his properties because he took a loan after he purchased the property. And now 1 week later, a word gets out that the property was sold, and the lokeach comes along. I mean, the matzron, the neighbor comes along, and he says to the lokeach, I want to buy the field. So does he have to take the field subject to this lien? So saying, no, he doesn't have to take the field subject to this lien, because the lien was just the was the business of the lokeach, of the purchaser, and not, you know, of the neighbor. He didn't. It wasn't a lien that was specifically in order for him to purchase this field. It was he took a loan in general. He took a loan in general. So we don't say that every single transaction that he conducts is necessarily a shlichus of the neighbor. But it's like the Rambam says, it's ki'ilu shliach for these purposes, basically of just whatever was the purchase price that he paid for the field. So in that respect, he's considered to be a shliach for the next door neighbor. Whether he paid a lot, whether he paid a little, he's considered to be the shliach of the neighbor. In fact, there's a tshuva by Rabbi Avraham ben Aramam, in which he speaks about this particular notion. It's kind of interesting. And he says, don't think that my father meant to say that he's a full-fledged shliach. If you look at his lashon, the Rambam said, you see that in Surah Zayin, ki'ilu shliach, p'shtel ben ha-metzer. He says, if it's a shliach. For certain purposes, we consider lokeach to be a shliach of the matzah and of the next door neighbor. So the Gemara, going back to the Gemara in source Dalet, so it gives you all of these different case scenarios. So Zavan, if you look in sort of the middle of the excerpt that I have, when this line that begins with the line that begins with Vehilchasa. So the end of that line says, Zavin Mameya Veshavi Masan. Let's say that the purchaser bought it for $100 or, you know, for $100,000, and it's really worth $200,000. Chazinin Lakuli Amakum Islina Mazvin, Yavli Meya Veshakule. If for the whole world, the seller would have sold it for a low price, so then that's the market price. Below Yavli Masan Veshakule. But if he was doing a special favor, for this particular purchaser, but really for anybody else, he would have charged $200,000. So then the neighbor is obligated to pay the $200,000 in such a case, because we say that was the market price. Because if there was a special relationship between the seller and the purchaser, we have to take that into account. So, for example, the Shulchan Aruch paskens that if the seller doesn't sell it altogether, just gives it as a matana, an outright gift, so then the whole din of bar mitzvah doesn't apply altogether, because an outright gift, that's a different sort of relationship, that's a different sort of transaction. We don't say that you get whatever value you're getting from the purchaser, you can get from somebody else. Obviously, if you're giving a gift to the purchaser, so you got some sort of a value from the purchaser that you're not going to get from somebody else. That's why you gave it as a gift. So you didn't have an interest in giving it as a gift to the entire universe. So therefore, that's considered to be off limits from the law of bar mitzvah. What about the case of Zavim Masim Shav Yameh? We discussed, he sold it for 200,000, it's really only worth 100,000. Shavim, no, so you might have thought that because it's a shliach type of thing, so that's why we have this principle that it's not, you can't save lo labuse, if that was the price, that was the price. And then the Gemara has a few cases where it says that if it was sold, in such a way that let's say that a person had sold land in the middle of their field to somebody else, so there's no bar mitzvah because all around this middle portion of the seller's field are other fields belonging to the seller, but now he wants to sell an adjacent field to the guy who bought in the middle of his field. So then we're worried about that, since the whole principle of bar mitzvah, so asisa yasha ve'atov, so we don't let people get around it or exercise it in a way that is precisely counter to the purpose of good ethical behavior. So now a person became a neighbor solely because the seller is kind of creating an artificial acquisition to this person by giving them a tiny piece of land in the middle of their field so that they could be considered to be a neighboring, a landowner. So now they want to sell the rest of the field, which is right next to it, which also conveniently happens to also be the field which is next to the neighbor, so that the neighbor will no longer be able to protest. So then we say, if there was something special about this field, that it was this field, it was like special quality field, so we say, okay, so then we understand why that field may have been sold. But if otherwise, there's no rhyme or reason for a person to just sell a regular piece of land in the middle of their property, we say, irume kamarum. So whenever it looks like the whole thing was a harama, so then we don't allow a person to be treated as a neighbor for these purposes. Similarly, the Gemara later on talks about mashkanta, that according to one opinion, if a person has like a lien on that, they took a property as a collateral, they made a loan, and then they took the property as collateral for the loan, and now the seller, the owner of the property, wants to sell it to somebody else, so the person who has collateral is considered as if they have an interest in the property, and they can exercise bar mitzvah rights. So let's say that it's either them or some neighbor, so this person has the right to say, well, since I have a possessory interest in the property, like a shutup on some level, because I have a lien on the property, so therefore the neighbor doesn't get to exercise bar mitzvah rights. So let's say that it's a small loan of like $5 or so that was made like right before the sale of the property, so that this person would be able to have a lien on the property, a mashkanta, in order to prevent the neighbor from exercising bar mitzvah rights. So therefore we say that too would be irume kamarim. So whenever there is a haroma involved, so then we don't allow bar mitzvah rights to be exercised. So we're always very much on the lookout for haroma. The one of the tshuvas written by the Hagos of Maimonios. Hagos Maimonios wrote tshuvas Maimonios, so you'll find in the Rambam. So he has a tshuva there that's written. He says that I'm sick, I'm old, I'm in bed most of the day, I can hardly get up, but I found out about this terrible avla that this person made a little loan on property in order to be able to have that mashkanta, to have a lien, to prevent the next door neighbor from being able to exercise bar mitzvah rights when the field was sold. And this is a terrible avla, because after all, this is based on the pasuk in the Torah, v'asisa yashav etov, and it's karo the mitzvah sesed. This is the strongest statement that you'll find in the Rishonim. He says it's kolov mitzvah sesi because of the fact that this takanas chachamim was premised upon the pasuk of sisa yashavato. He says it's kolov mitzvah sesi. So that's how seriously you have to take it, and therefore he says you have to be very, very careful to avoid harama, because harama basically thwarts the entire purpose of this halacha, which is be'asisa hayasher behatov. So these are now the last. Halacha is very, very important. If you go to, so it's the last four lines of the sugya, the last three lines of the sugya. Limcha barachok ligo b'karov. Let's say that the seller was really in dire straits, and the seller was pressed that they had to sell land, like faraway land, in order to be able to buy land that was conveniently located, or barav ligo b'yafer, or they need to sell like bad real estate so that they'd be able to have good real estate, and they're very, very pressured. And if the seller knows that there's a chance that they might have to turn around the property and give it to somebody else, they're not going to buy it in the first place. So whenever it's going to be to the detriment of the seller, like the seller really desperately needs to get rid of this property, really is in need of money, you know, immediately, and by virtue of requiring him to be subject to the laws of Bar Mitzvah, he's going to end up losing out. So there's a general proposition that we were never misaken. Chazal was never, since the whole purpose is Rasisa Yav Shevetov, Chazal was never misaken the entire din of Bar Mitzvah is going to end up hurting the Mocher. Now we'll see that they also weren't misaken if it's going to end up really hurting the Lokeach. Because why should it be any different? Because the idea is that if it's otherwise a neutral proposition, nobody's going to get hurt. And you're ending up, you know, helping this neighbor who's going to be in a better position, so then we want to help the neighbor. But if it's going to have this counterproductive effect, that it's going to end up hurting the seller, or even, as we'll see, the purchaser, so then we don't apply the dinim bar mitzvah. So we say as well, that's why we have, if a person sells to a woman, or sells to Yisomim, also Leisba Mishim Dina de Bar Mitzvah, because it's very difficult, at least certainly in those days, it's very difficult for a woman to engage in, you know, commerce, and in sort of in the outside world as easily as men. And even nowadays, we don't want, Lav Aruch Ara, we say, we don't want a woman to have to be as involved in commercial transactions. We want the woman, if she, Kokuda Basna Panima, if she wants to spend most of her time, you know, taking care of her family and so forth, we want her to have the luxury to do that. So she's going to buy a field, and then we're going to tell her 2 days later, sorry, you got to sell the field, you got to sell the field to the neighbor, you got to look for another field. So we don't impose that burden upon a woman. We certainly don't impose that burden upon Yisomim Ketanim. We're not going to impose that burden. So we see over here that even if it's a Lokeach is going to lose out, we're not going to impose the principle of Dina de Bar Mitzvah. So this is very, very interesting, because we have the next sugya that talks about this, at least in the notes, is the sugya at the beginning of Bababasa. We know that the sugya there, everyone knows, Runya. All kinds of interesting sugyas about Runya and Ravina. Ravina built, you know, of these fences around Runya's field and so forth. Is he responsible to pay or not? So the next sugya in the Gemara, Nepeim and Aleph, says Runya bought a field, a mitzvah to Ravina, but the field that he bought happened to be next door to where Ravina's field was. So Ravina figured, Bar Mitzvah, wonderful. So Ravina Slukim Mishim Dina to Bar Mitzvah. Ravina figured, I'm going to pay off Runya in order to buy this field, which is next to my field. So Amale Rav Safa Breda Rav Yeba, Ravina, nothing doing. Amin Shi Abel Tzila Abel Tzilala. Because, you know, four for the tzila and four for the tzilala. So nobody knows what that means, four for the tzila and four for the tzilala. There are at least three different perushim, what it means, four for the tzila and four for the tzilala. But what Rashi says that it means is that a tzala is talking about like a person who is a shoemaker who is poor, and a tzilala is like a shoemaker who is rich. And he was saying, just like the rich person needs to eat, so too a poor person needs to eat. And this person is a very poor person, and he des runya, is a poor person, and he needs the sadeh for his parnasa. And therefore, since he's such a poor person, and the whole purpose of Bar Mitzvah is mishum asisa yashav yatov, kachani yomei lecha, say yashav yatov la'anizeh, that you have to have rachmanus for this poor person. Don't make this poor person turn around and have to sell his field. He needs to make a profit off the field. He needs to be able to generate, you know, food from working in the field every single day. So this is a case when we're not going to apply by the principle of Bar Mitzvah, when the lokeach desperately needs the field. From the perspective of Runya, from the perspective of Ravina, so Ravina already has lots of fields. Ravina is a rich person. He just, you know, he's going to buy the field for like extra profit. He'll have a more expansive estate if he has this field. But from Runya's perspective, it'll be his ruination. if he's not able to hold on to this field. And therefore, in such a case, we're not going to apply the principle of Bar Mitzvah. So Tosfos has a very interesting criticism of the comments of Rashi and says, whoa, how could that be a reason not to apply the principle of Bar Mitzvah? The Perish HaKuntris Makshar Benatam Ha'in Merachim Ibedin. We're talking about when you have like a din Torah, you gotta just look at the facts. You gotta look at what the din is. The din is we have on the books this idea of Bar Mitzvah, so we're not supposed to have Rachmanus. So Rashi would presumably respond in turn. The whole purpose of the din of Bar Mitzvah is Rachmanus. That's why it was established based on Hasisa Yashatov. This is one exception to the rule of Ein Merachim Ibedin. This is all based upon Rachmanus. So Tosfos gives, you know, different explanations that that really Runya also was a neighbor, but he only had one adjacent field, and Ravina had three adjacent fields. But it doesn't matter if you have one; you have the same rights as the person who has three. And if Runya got there first, they all got in there at the same time, we would have split it, you know, 75%, 25%. But since they didn't, you know, all get there at the same time, Runya got it first. Therefore, Runya doesn't have to give it up. And there's another shot if you look in Tosfos that's given by Harav Avram that we're not going to get to right now because it doesn't seem to be brought down so much lahalacha. So, does this play out in terms of the actual halacha? So this is very, very interesting. If you take a look in the next two sources, Yud Aleph and Yud Beis, okay, moving right along, so you find some of these principles of the Gemara described in the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch in terms of when we don't apply the halacha of Bar Mitzvah because it's going to end up hurting somebody else. So in Sif Yud Aleph, this is straight out of the Gemara. That's the last case of the Gemara. You know, most of these things, most of these laws, you can derive straight from the Gemara to figure out when we're going to apply Bar Mitzvah. Malkalisha Lisham Ketonim, Eimam Shimdina de Bar Mitzvah. And this is a very interesting idea. Because you think about when you're going to apply the halachos of Bar Mitzvah nowadays, there's already a germ of an idea that's beginning to percolate over here. Maybe some of you are, you know, already, you know, legally, or thinking creatively from a legal perspective. If you sell to a woman, you sell to a woman, so we just said, is that we don't want to bother a woman to have to give up the field after she purchases it, so there's no din of Bar Mitzvah, and certainly, and the same thing applies to minor Yisomim. Fine, we understand. What is the Ramah yet? V'daki shesheshla nechasim yiduim, or Amana, and she says, this is how Ramah says, again, you always have to worry about Harama. You know, maybe the woman, if we think that the woman's really buying it on behalf of her husband, and he's the one who's getting it, and we're not so worried about inconveniencing the husband, he can go in and buy another field, so then this doesn't apply. Shameless, so it's only if the woman is an almana, or she has her own nechasim, shein lachos shemaremes, or kona levayla v'omeres le'atzma. However, look at this next case. This is a very interesting case. Very interesting case. I mean, it made me thinking. You know, it caused me to think. This next case, and then I searched around to see if anybody wrote a tshuva on this, and sure enough, it turned out somebody did. So this next case is Kansa Hib Baila Biyachad. What if a woman and her husband buy a field together? Oh, yeah, that never happens. They buy a house, jointly owned house. Does that sound familiar? Isn't that the way that, like, you know, most couples buy houses nowadays? I remember that, you know, when at one point I had a friend who once advised me, when you buy a house, you should only buy it in your wife's name because, you know, this way if you ever get sued for any reason for lots of money, so they won't be able to go after the house. I don't know if that's true, but I didn't worry about it so much. I did once get sued for $4 million. Because we had a case in the Beis Din, when I was in the Beis Din of America, in which we issued a seiruv, we issued a contempt order against the husband who wasn't giving his wife a get, was showing up to the Beis Din for a proceeding regarding the get, and he sued me for defamation, for issuing the seiruv against him, and he claimed that I threatened to break both of his legs, you know, in the process, which was kind of interesting. So he said that he had a telephone message to that effect. And we actually tried, like, discovery to find, like, the telephone. I really wanted to hear the telephone message. It would have been interesting. But he dropped the case, so that was that. But it was all right. So anyway, and he ended up giving his wife a get. So, you know, it all ended well. So, kansi yavayla biyachad. So if they buy the property together, en yuchon lasalik afilu abal. So it's a very interesting close to Mibash. Mibash says that in that case, let's say that we would split up the field and we would say that, well, the wife owns a portion and the husband owns a portion because they bought it together. So maybe, you know, we can't banish the wife from her portion and force her to sell her portion of the field because she's a woman, but maybe the husband, we could force him to sell, you know, his portion of the field. We say no, because he became a bar mitzvah of the wife's field. And therefore we can't, you know, so since he's a bar mitzvah now, you know, so we can't kick him off of his field either, even though he only became a bar mitzvah at that point in time, which is kind of interesting. But that's what the Rivash says. But then you gotta have to wonder. So does that mean that, since we do say that the wife has these rights of bar mitzvah, even when she buys the field together with her husband, so does that mean in every single case nowadays, where you would have purchasers who would be a husband-wife team, we wouldn't apply the halacha of bar mitzvah? So that's kind of like what I was thinking about. I had like a couple of things I was thinking about. This one, we'll see this tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer that addresses it. The other thing that I was thinking about is that it's kind of like funny the way that it works, because if the Mochen never has to say a word. He never has to say a word to the neighbor. You know, it says there's a halacha. If he says something to the neighbor, maybe it's a nice thing for him to do. Maybe it's a good idea. Maybe the purchaser will appreciate that he got the neighbor out of the way. You know, so if he says something to the neighbor and the neighbor says, "Oh, machalach, machalach, machalach," then he sells the property. So at that point in time, the neighbor has no right to go to the purchaser to buy up the property. We understand that. But it's kind of interesting because if he would have said absolutely nothing to the neighbor, and then the neighbor only finds out about it, you know, after the purchase already takes place, and then we say the purchaser was his agent, and then he can pay off the agent at that point in time. So it's, in a way, the neighbor is, you know, I guess a lot better off never having this conversation, you know, with the owner in the first place. But it's just kind of an interesting thing that there's no prejudice over the fact that the neighbor was not involved. The neighbor could have known about it. Even if the neighbor knew everything about the transaction and chose never to say a word, never to say a peep the entire time, and just waited, you know, bit his lip until after the transaction took place and said, "Here I am, you know, thank you very much for being my shliach, I'm going to, you know, take the property from you," that's perfectly fine. But in the event that he actually had this interaction with the seller, so then he can no longer do it. I find it interesting. Whatever. So now, if you look in Sif Yud Beis, so here's where we have kind of this discussion from the Machlokas Rashi and Tosas regarding Runya. Now we're talking about, so we spoke about in the previous Sif, we spoke about if it's a woman. What if this Lokeach, who happens to be in dire straits, he's a poor fellow like Runya. That's the case of Runya and Ravina, the way that Rashi understood it. That Lokeach wants it in order to expand his riches, but the Matzron wants it to expand his riches, but the Lokeach is somebody who, you know, is in dire straits and desperately needs the property. So Yesh Omen, the Leis Beit Vishum Dinah de Bar Mitzvah, V'yesh Achokin. So some say that there is no Din of Bar Mitzvah in this case, meaning the Lokeach gets to keep the field, like Rashi. Runya gets to keep the field. But there are those who disagree, and he quotes Tosos along those lines. So he says, Midibim Maram, Nirak is Svar HaRishona. The Ramah basically paskins like Rashi Otosos. Which one? Like Rashi, right? Svar HaRishona. Basically paskins like Rashi, and so you have to look at the relative weights of the needs of the parties. Lokeach versus the Bar Mitzvah. Lokeach needs it much more desperately. That's a relevant consideration. But he says, V'dakash Lokeach min here. That's only like Lokeach is somebody from this city that, you know, really needs it in order to be able to live here. Lo'yochol so bayis makom achim. He doesn't find another place to live. But B'lavach in Matzvin kodem l'kuliyama. But otherwise, the Matzvin wins. So this is something to bear in mind. Now, I meant to have source chav dalad come afterwards. I don't know exactly what happened, but it appeared a little bit later in the source sheets. So if you jump to page 4, which is not giving you a break because you're going to have to go back afterwards, but if you jump to page 4 in the sif chav source chav dalad, so the Sma talks about this. He talks about this. If you go down, we'll skip, you know, about 5 lines to the bottom. Well, hecha the leisle lokeach bayis klal ika lemeimar. He says even the opinion that held that there always is a claim of bar mitzvah, which is the hagos maimonius, that has two opinions. Modim leis meishim dinah de bar mitzvah would agree that if the lokeach has no other place to live, that we should be making in this case. But if the lokeach could buy a house somewhere else, even if the house isn't as nice, and he wanted to buy a bigger, more expansive house that would be able to, you know, fit his 15 children, then the neighbor, even though the neighbor is presumably wealthier and doesn't need it as much, as the neighbor still wins out. It has to be like a very, very dire strait. So he's saying that it's very difficult to paskin like Rashi, if you look in the previous line, Mishum de Rizman is saying, Bikim Shabbat Bum the Dechikele Shaita. We don't know what's the level of poverty that would be, you know, required in order to give the Lokeach the break. Everybody has debts. Everybody has lots of monetary obligations and financial stress and so forth. So we don't want to do away with the law of Bar Mitzvah altogether. The whole law of Bar Mitzvah meant that regardless of the fact that everybody struggles to some degree, the neighbor will be able to benefit much more from being able to have this property, and the Lokeach could presumably buy land somewhere else. Instead, we could buy any land somewhere else, even if the land isn't as nice, we're not going to dispense with the law of Bar Mitzvah, and we will allow the neighbor to hold on to the land. Okay. But it's interesting that in the end of the day, this criticism of Tosfos of Ein Merachim and Bedin, we see doesn't really carry so much weight when it comes to this particular halacha that itself is based upon Rachmanis. So that's kind of like a very, very interesting, you know, notion. But what is he talking about, this Ma? He's talking about houses. What was the Gemara talking about? It was talking about fields. How do we know the Din of the Bar Mitzvah applies to houses altogether? We said it only applies to, like, if you can plow through everything together. You can't plow through two houses together, right? So if you look at the Rosh, say back in source Yud Gimel, the end of the very bottom of page 2, he quotes Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says, you know what? The Din of Bar Mitzvah does not apply to houses. We don't hold like Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says it does not. We hold it applies to houses. It applies to stores. It applies to cemetery plots. Okay, the only thing it doesn't, it applies to spaces in the base Knesset, when they used to sell the places where people would sit in the base Knesset, it even applies to that as well. It applies to practically everything. But what was, doesn't apply to Metalton. But what was it, to movables? But what was it that Rabbeinu Tam objected to when it came to applying Bar Mitzvah to houses? Three things. It says, Lo Shaak Dinah Bar Mitzvah Vatim Lebesod. There's a time when Shem Yachal Ikak Rokam Achim, Vatim Mitzvah Leknos. He says, a field, you can always buy a field somewhere else. But houses, it's not always, you know, the market is sometimes a little bit fickle. It's not always so easy to find somewhere else. But he says that when it comes to having a second house, so if a person already has one house, what do they need a second house so much for? You don't need a second house, a vacation house, an extra place in Boynton Beach, whatever. You don't need it, whatever. It's not as important to have the second house as to have the first house. And this locale, maybe he only needs it as the first house. What in the mice is the locale going to, is the matron going to do with his second house? He'll probably rent it out to other people in order to make some extra money. But, the person who's buying it, maybe he needs it to actually live in. Whenever there's a hefsek, a separation of land between one field and another field, we don't allow Bar Mitzvah. He started with Sonos. But and houses are also divided by walls. Houses don't just flow freely into each other, right? I mean, that's the whole idea of a house. You have walls. Good fences make good neighbors, right? He says, everything Rabbeinu Tam said makes a lot of sense to the Rosh. It says the Rosh, but that's not the Minog. It's not the Minog. So he said, why is it not the Minog? So Shulchan Aruch says, the Chok HaKol Sheba Olam is the source of your Dalet, Simen Kuf of Ayin Hei, Sifn Nun Gimel. The Chok HaKol Sheba Olam, Yesh Din Matzranos, that the law of Matzranos applies to all Karkos, except for not Metaltlin and not Avodim. Mechuba L'Karka Kikarka. What does Mechuba L'Karka Kikarka mean? It means houses, improvements, also have the same din as Karka. V'yesh bo din Matzranos. V'lechen yesh din Matzranos bebatim, v'wadim b'mekomos beis haKnesses. It's very interesting. By the way, I'll tell you just, it's sort of like this intuitive thing of like proper ethical behavior. I'll just like give you an example in everyday life of how there is this intuitive notion that people have that if somebody is sitting in one seat, that there's some sort of a possessory right that based on the convenience of being able to have the seat next to them. This happens all the time. You go to a gate at the airport. There's a basic understanding everybody has. You don't sit next to somebody who's sitting in a seat because maybe they need that place because they want to put down their suitcase there, their laptop. Maybe they have a child or spouse that's coming there. You just don't plop yourself down without at least asking next to the seat where somebody's already occupied. If you think about it, you just don't do it. If you do it, you'll generally, regret it because the person will say, oh, I'm sorry, that place is already taken. But I think that there is sort of like this intuitive notion that everybody has that there is something to this. There is something to this idea. Even when it comes to, let's say, seats in a base classes, it really makes a lot of sense. So Shulchan Aruch says it does apply to houses. So you take a look at the Sma in Sif Tesvav. This is coming to exclude the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, who says it doesn't apply to houses. But Tam, the Chomish Ben Abatim, he says the reason is because the wall between the houses, Yecholim Nafasko, Shikanes Mizeh Lezeh. Because you know what you can do with a wall? You can break it down! You can break it down, right? And in terms of the need for having the extra space, often people need the extra space because they have children and grandchildren that, you know, they need to bring into the extra space. They're not necessarily going to rent it out, right? So he says that I mentioned all the reasons that Rabbeinu Tam brought. The Sma mentioned all the reasons. I didn't repeat them because I already had them in the Rosh. In order to be able to learn that a Dayan has to take into account all of these different considerations, because if the Dayan, Shim ein a Dayan roe, ein, in this case with an ayin, ein is in the eye of the Dayan, roe sheyesh tzad yosher v'tov shol salik alokeach, that there is a countervailing, hayosher v'tov, not to remove the lokeach and to let the lokeach rather than the neighbor remain in the property. Shiyoko tsaris svaros enough. He can utilize these svaros, the mashein avos, livsok shadidim alokeach, and allow the lokeach to remain in the property. So what was one of the things that Rabbeinu Tam said? Rabbeinu Tam said, it's not really right to let the matzon expand upon his estate and his property just for the purpose of making investment income off of it, renting it out to other people if he needs it. Yeah, for his children, grandchildren, and so forth, his family is growing, whatever. So then, you know, that's understandable. But if it's just for purposes of renting out, so that doesn't really, you know, make sense. So I heard this. So who says that? It's interesting. I looked in the Sefer Pisklei Choshen. The Sefer Pisklei Choshen discusses all these things. He says, you look in most of the poskim, they don't really bring that as a criticism for Rabbeinu Tam. The main reason Rabbeinu Tam is rejected is because you can knock down the wall. People don't say Rabbeinu Tam is rejected because it's perfectly legitimate for a matzron to want the adjacent property in order to make investment income off of it, in order to rent it out. So that's what the Sholem Meisher said. The Sholem Meisher dealt with the case of matzronus. Details don't matter so much. You could read, you know, all of the details. In a case where the neighbor was going to acquire the property mostly to rent it out to somebody else. So he said, the din of bar mitzvah doesn't apply in this particular case. If the whole purpose of bar mitzvah is that's yachol ha'chid gebulo, that the person can expand, you know, their own boundaries, and this person is just going to rent it out to somebody else. So he said, I think the lokeach has a clear possessory right in the property. On a deraisa level, he purchased the property. The bar mitzvah only has sort of this takanas chachamim rights. It's a suffix whether it really applies in this case. Ain't suffix motzimi devadai, and therefore I let the lokeach stay in the property in that particular case. I heard from Rav Schechter as well. Rav Schechter had a couple of interesting cases of a bar mitzvah that he mentioned. So he said he also thinks if the person is just interested in the adjacent house for investment income, then the halacha bar mitzvah shouldn't apply. It's not really mefurish. It's not mefurish in the Shulchan Aruch or anything. It's that the Sholem Eishev has this idea. Sholem Eishev has this idea. The Pesachei Choshen said, I don't find it anywhere. Because everyone who rejected Rabbeinu Tam didn't reject Rabbeinu Tam for that reason. So it sounds like that is a legitimate reason. You need extra investment income. Well, why shouldn't a person take advantage of the opportunity to have, you know, the land next door? He says, but then it's not an expansion of your other house if you're just using it for investment income. So therefore, the Sholem Eishev says that he doesn't think it would apply in this case. Well, Shechter said, different case. He said he had a case of a yeshiva in New Jersey. He said something yeshiva in New Jersey. I don't know the case. Yeshiva in New Jersey that they had their yeshiva building and they wanted to buy the building next door, presumably for dormitory purposes for the students and so forth. Otherwise, they would have to buy a place three blocks away and it would be, you know, inconvenient. The students have to walk very far. I mean, I know because I have boys in different yeshivas. You know, the ones who have, you know, a dormitory which is like next door or, you know, a block away, it's a lot easier for them than the ones who have to, like, you know, go across a mountain and a valley, you know, to get to their dormitory. So they wanted to be able to buy it. And he said that there was a witch next door, okay, that was his term, who really, really did not, you know, like the yeshiva, and she decided she's going to sell it, but she's not going to sell it to the yeshiva. You know, she's not going to sell it to the yeshiva, she's going to sign herself to sell it. They were willing to pay whatever price, you know, she was going to charge it to somebody else. So he said that's a violation of, you know, Dina de Bar Mitzvah. It's an interesting story. But anyway, you know, in the course of that conversation, he said that if it's only being used for investment purposes, so, you know, then, you know, presumably we wouldn't say Bar Mitzvah, but it's not mefurish. It's not so pashut, but that's how the Sholem Meshiv Paskins. And, you know, certainly that was one of the considerations of Rabbeinu Tam as to why not to apply it to houses. So it could be that maybe, according to the Sma, that we would still take that consideration into account in terms of saying when Bar Mitzvah does not apply.
Okay. Disclose the purpose that they're buying it for.
I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I guess that it's something that could be investigated, meaning that if the Lokeach wants to argue that the matzron shouldn't be allowed to take it away from him, so he can make that claim, and then the Beis Din can evaluate the claim. Remember, if it comes in front of the Beis Din, so then the claim can be advanced, and the Beis Din presumably has the right to evaluate the claim, right? So the halachas here, I'll just, you know, run through the basic idea, starting in Yud-Zayin Ches related to the case in the Beis Din, that in the Beis Din of America that I described to you before. But in SIP, source Yotes, so source Yotes again talks about how we're not looking to create a hefsed for the mocher. So if I have two people, and this is also a very interesting halacha, that if the matzron announces, this is very interesting, it's very interesting, if the matzron announces his interest in purchasing the property at the time the property is sold, but he says, oh, but it's going to take me a lot more time to get the money, so then the mocher says, well, I'm not going to wait for you that long. I need to sell it right now to lokeach. So he sells it to lokeach, and then that's it. Meaning that if the matzron had said absolutely nothing at that point in time, had just like figured out while the sale was taking place how he's going to get his money together, so he'll have it the next day after the sale is completed, and then he could show up at the lokeach's door, knock on the door, and say, oh, I want to purchase, you know, the property now. Then we give him the property. But because he was there at the time of the sale, and he said, I want to purchase the property rather than the lokeach, oh, but by the way, I'm going to need some time to get the money. So then we say, well, the mocher, you know, loses out if he has to spend time, because maybe he won't get the money, maybe the lokeach will disappear. So then the property goes to lokeach, and then the matzon, the neighbor, has no right to assert his claim afterwards. It's kind of a very interesting thing when you think about that.
The offers aren't equivalent. If he can't come up with the money for another 3 months, 6 months, whatever, then the lokeach's offer is better.
What I'm saying is that lokeach's offer is better, but lokeach is the sale's going to go through today. The matzron doesn't have the funds. Or he has money, but the money is not as good money, right? That's the other case. He has money, but it's not as good as the lokeach's money. Rav Ezra Batzer gives the example, lokeach's paying dollars. And dollars like the best currency, because everybody loves dollars all over. He's writing from an Israeli, you know, vantage point. You know, what he says is dollars, and that's gold. You know, and the matzron says, oh, I'm sorry, you don't have dollars. So today, when he says, I want to go forward and buy the property, he's going to take a little bit of time. He doesn't have the best currency. So then we say it goes to lokeach, and that's the end of the story. The matzron has no rights further than that. But if the matzron wouldn't have said anything, and the transaction, and instead, he would have kept his mouth shut and would have spent the entire day getting financing, getting the money that he needed. And then the next day, he shows up at the lokeach's house and says, oh, I found out you just purchased his property and here's the money, that he'd be able to purchase it from him. So that's what I find. I'm telling you this right now. I didn't find anyone who discussed this conundrum. I just found it to be a little bit of a conundrum. I found it interesting. And I looked and looked to see if anybody discusses, you know, why this should be. Maybe you could say that, well, if he doesn't have it today, he probably won't have it tomorrow or something like that. But I don't know. I find that to be, I don't have a perfect explanation to give you. You know, I can explain, you know, why the waiver, you know, thing, you know, makes sense. You know, when he gives the waiver beforehand so he can't come back afterwards. But this is interesting. Or something that requires maybe further thought.
It seems to stretch it beyond the amount that it should be accepted. You don't believe that?
That what?
It seems to stretch the concept
of the
cease of Tobi Yosher. It seems to stretch it too far.
By what? By applying it to houses? Or by saying that the lokeach gets it, that the matzon gets to walk over to the lokeach and give him the funds after the sale takes place?
Right.
But that's the main, according to the Aruch HaShulchan, that's the main takana. That's the main takana, is that we make the lokeach into essentially a shliach. So maybe we could say like this, that maybe all of this is happening because the lokeach doesn't want to go through the sale knowing about the dinim of bar mitzvah unless he knows he can get the matzon out of the picture ahead of time. So therefore, he wants to make sure before he even does the sale, and that's why we're talking about these cases, that the matzon is out of the picture. Either the matzon waives his rights in the mokum, he makes a kinyan, you know, with the lokeach, and he makes a kinyan with the lokeach, then after the sale takes place, he's not going to be able to go back to lokeach afterwards. Or, at the time of the sale, the lokeach just doesn't want to do the sale if the matzon is going to come out with the money. He says, so you have coming up with the money? You're not coming up with the money. He says, I'm going to have to wait a day. Good, fine, so then I'll do the sale. But otherwise, maybe the lokeach doesn't want to do the sale altogether. Maybe that's the explanation. Maybe that's not a bad beer. That's not a bad beer. Okay, so I'm not going into all of the sources that begin here with Chavav. The purpose of everything that follows the source Chavav, which is about six different sifim towards the end of Siman Kuf Ayin Hey, is to show you that there's a lot of confusion in one particular area. And what's that area? The area is, what are the matzron rights of a tenant? What rights does a tenant have to be able to, number one, acquire the property next door to the one that they're renting, where we have a machlokis, the Rambam and the Rosh. The Rambam says, no rights whatsoever. And the Rosh says, no, a tenant is considered to be like an owner, because a skius is a memka liyomahu. It's considered to be like a temporary sale, so therefore it's considered like he owns the property next door, and therefore he has masrin rights if the property, next door is going to be sold, to be able to sell that property, to be able to buy that property before some third party would buy the property. And then the second question that's discussed is, if somebody is a tenant in a particular house, and now the seller wants to sell that house, so does the tenant have a greater right than everybody else? And that also is a machlokas, but it's a machlokas based on a totally different principle, based on the principle of mashkanta, that we say that a person who's not necessarily a next-door neighbor, but a creditor, a lender, who has a lien on the property because he loaned money, so he takes precedence, we said, over a matzrin. According to some opinions, he takes precedence over a matzrin. That's also a machlokas between the machaber and the ramah, whether he takes precedence over the next-door neighbor. So do we say that the ramah who holds that would be true with respect to a mashkanta, do we say that the same thing would be true with respect to a socher, that a socher is considered as if, since he's possessing the property right now, this isn't a matzron right, because it's not the next property, it's not the adjacent property, because he's possessing the property right now, so therefore he has a greater right if he wants to purchase this property than, let's say, a third party, or the next door neighbor. So the basic approach is that since it's a little unclear with respect to the tenant loses with respect to the next door neighbor, but the tenant wins with respect to a third party. But if the sale has already taken place, and the right wasn't asserted until after the sale took place, so nobody can kick anybody out, because everybody has some sort of a claim. The tenant would be able to claim, I follow the Ramah that says that, I have this interest, and a third-party purchaser would be able to make the claim that I follow the Machaber, who says that the Socher doesn't have this interest. So those are the basic principles that are laid down. If you look in the Piskei Tshuva, Source Chav Zayin, by the Shavus Yaakov, and that's basically the bottom line of the equation. But it's very, very interesting, because this question does come up, from time to time as well, with respect to tenant rights. So the last source, and we'll just, conclude with this, is the Tzitz Eliezer, who comes up with what I think is sort of this wild idea. It's not so wild, that whenever you have husband and wife that buy a property together, you could basically bypass the whole bar mitzvah situation, because you could rely upon the halacha that we don't apply bar mitzvah with respect to a woman, and according to the Rivosh, it sounds like it's even if she is married that we don't apply it. So he says this was the case. We're a little bit over. The case was that we have mochrim, sellers that sell the house to a wife and to a husband and a wife for a certain amount of money. And now the Le'acham Ikein, Hikish Negdam Tzviya Socher Shigar B'Dira. So now this is also a Socher that actually lived in the Dira, right? And he wants to assert, this Bar Mitzvah rights, because we said, according to the Ramah, a Socher also has, certain rights, right? If he lived in the house. Uva B'Tainas Bar Mitzvah, and Tan Shemuchan L'Shan L'Mochim, also Skum Shemeshama L'Hemakonim, he said, I'm prepared to pay the same amount. And the Nitbayim, the Mochim and the Konim, they say, well, first of all, this person who lived in the house, he knew about this for a very, very long time. And he was well aware of this. And they gave him, you know, a lot of time to buy this for himself, and he didn't take a single step along those lines. And if anything, he made it really, really difficult for them to buy it. And because of that, they were sort of forced into a very difficult situation. And the mocher was not prepared to buy it under any circumstances. So he said, who wins this then? At this point in time, there was already a contract, but the sale hadn't gone through. So, you know, you didn't have kind of like this argument to make that, you know, in the Socher situation, the Shus Yaakov said that everybody else, like a third-party purchaser, is in much better shape if the sale already went through, but the sale didn't go through in this case. So his main argument is that the halacha bar mitzvah doesn't apply altogether when the sale is to a woman. And he quotes from the Ribash, and he says that what about, you'll say that you have a husband who, you know, can do the work to purchase another property in this particular case. So you're not putting the woman, out. So he says that we go after the general principles. If you look in the paragraph that begins with Yunyeh, the Ayin, B'shuayi Sashuas Haribash, about the three lines before the bottom, the Stam Ishalav Orcha Lemitrach, the Afagav the Islay Baal, even though Islay Baal, even though she has a husband, that, you know, in many marriage situations, it's the woman who does, like, you know, all the legwork. Like when we bought our house here in Chicago, I never looked at the house before it was bought altogether. You know, my wife went with my mother-in-law, and they checked out the house and so forth. So she already put herself through so much trouble. She can't rely on her husband that if this falls through, that he's going to be there to check out the next house. Maybe she'll have to do all that work again. And we still have the principle of la baruch ha'ara, that it's not something that we want to impose upon a woman. And therefore, we're not going to obligate her. So he said that in this particular case, therefore we would apply this principle that the din of bar mitzvah doesn't apply because there is a woman involved. And therefore he cannot come up with the argument of bar mitzvah, even if he's going to argue that by virtue of being a socher he's like some sort of a shoot-up or something like that. In any event, we don't really paskin like that opinion. And even though if you look at the next page, the last page, the chatzchiva, we definitely do give a socher generally some sort of a preferential treatment. However, in this particular case, because there is since the kohen is an isha, he loses that edifus, he loses that preferential treatment, and especially given that they already had the contract in this particular case, and the mochrim already received the down payment in this particular case, and even if the down payment isn't a completion of the transaction, it at least creates a mishapara kind of completion of the transaction, which also counts as something. And the Konim already lost a lot of money because they already invested a lot in terms of all of their hard work. I don't know if that really would normally be such a strong halakha consideration, but basically what he's saying is that in every individual case where there is a claim of bar mitzvah, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances in terms of where does the basisa yosha v'atov fall out. And therefore he says, and therefore based on all these considerations, near the alpi halakha, zochah konim b'kniyas adira, v'imakom l'tainas bar mitzvah, that's what's considered to be the Tovei Yishar. And we will stop here.
So Marshall's my next door neighbor. My wife calls him.